I'd like now to welcome back to the program Jackie Fleming. She's the founder of the Cimarron Sky Dog Reserve Wild Horse Sanctuary, and Donna Wells. She's producer and director of the film She Had Some Horses, and that film will be screened tomorrow night at Collected Works Bookstore at 7 in the evening. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great, thank you.
Hi.
And it's a whole event. It's not only the film screening, but also there is a reception for the winners of a photograph contest, which we'll be talking about in just a few minutes. Let's talk about this film. This is about, it's about horses, and it's just as much about women. How did you come to make it?
Well, I started thinking about this when Lynn Pomerantz and I went to film school together. We went to the Anthropology Film Center that used to be up on Upper Canyon Road when we both first came to Santa Fe in 1989. And she has been a horse enthusiast and photographer for quite a long while. And we were going to do a project together about the prisoners out at the prison who were training the wild horses that were brought in from the BLM land. And we began work on that project, and then sadly BLM pulled the plug on it, and the project was discontinued out at the prison in Santa Fe.
That's really too bad.
It is too bad because it was a great project. The prisoners really gained a lot of, they felt good about themselves working with the horses, and the horses benefited because it made them easier to be adopted when they'd been worked with. And the cowboys that were the head of the project out there were great and instilled really good values in the prisoners. And it was a way
That's a total win-win situation for everybody.
It was a win-win situation, so it was sad when it stopped. But Lynn and I have remained friends, and she's gone on to be a great equine photographer. And so this 2 years ago, I started taking classes out at the Santa Fe Community College and in their film program. And when I thought about what project I wanted to work on, I thought about this again and about that connection between women and horses.
Now, what do you mean, that connection between women and horses? Do women have a particular connection to horses?
Well, I feel that they do. I've been riding quarter horses for the last 11 years. I kind of came to riding horses later in life, and most of the people that I rode with were women, and the trainers that I trained with were women, and I just saw a real rapport, a real closeness in the women and their interactions with the horses.
So you've got a lot of different kinds of people in the movie, including Jackie. You got involved with this because you have the Cimarron Sky Dog Horse Sanctuary. Tell us a little bit, we'll come back to the film, but tell us about the sanctuary.
I have 28 horses, most of which are Mustangs. Some came from the BLM and some came from the Forestry Service in New Mexico. And the simple mission is to be able to turn those horses loose on open range. And I've been lucky enough this last year to be able to lease 1,000 acres up by Watrous. And we do have 420 acres as well. And so a good group, about 20 of our horses have been out on the range for over a year and a half now. And the goal is to get them all out there year-round, even in a drought. So that's going to require a lot of land so that you don't overgraze the land even under dire circumstances. And earlier this year with the drought, it was a real eye-opener to see that even 1,000 acres with 20 horses on it, it's not enough for...
Is that right? 1,000 acres can't support 20... Well, I guess in times of a drought.
In times of a drought, in dire situations. I mean, later in the summer, we got bonanza rains up there. And then you look at it and you go, wow, these horses could never eat this in a million years.
Right.
But it can go from one extreme to the other. And since New Mexico is such an unpredictable climate, you cannot guarantee it's going to be a rainy summer. And there's all these little microclimates that happen. It might be a rainy summer 5 miles down the road, but it isn't there. So, I mean, I'm as much as a land conservationist as I am Mustangs, and so I don't want to be damaging the land. So for us to take on any more horses, we have to be guaranteed a lot more land, because I don't want them standing in corrals. They may as well be back at the BLM pens if they're just going to stand around in corrals.
So the land you lease, is that public land? Is that BLM land?
It's all private land where our horses are. It used to be a 10,000-acre ranch that got subdivided. And we were able to buy a few of those lots for 400, you know, to make 420 acres. But the rest of that ranch is still for sale. So, you know, I'm buying my lottery tickets and talking to anybody out there with some dollars in their pocket to try and be able to buy some more of that land for the horses and to conserve it, because it would be very sad to see houses go up. And there's a huge elk population on that land, and you know, it's got Santa Fe Trail wagon ruts that cross right through it.
Right.
And I'm a huge history buff, so I just get so excited when I see all that. So, I mean, our goal now is to be able in some way to expand the land before we bring on any more horses into the sanctuary, because we want them to be free-roaming horses.
One of the themes in your film, Donna Wells, is not only the relationship between women and horses, but what horses represent. I mean, there's this sense of freedom that wild horses represent, which I think reflects a kind of freedom that every human is looking for.
That's true. I think the horses are a symbol of freedom, and they certainly were an important ingredient in how the West was won. And I think that gets forgotten in this day and age, that we probably wouldn't have been able to settle the West so quickly had we not had horses. And I think that because of that historical importance, that that we need to take care of them, and we need to make sure that they thrive and can remain free on the public lands, which is what was guaranteed in the 1971 Free Roaming Horse and Burro Act. So,
which is, seems to be, how should we say it, not being followed.
It's not being followed. It's under quite a bit of pressure for the horses and their rights to be disregarded. There's always the dollar that seems to be the important ingredient there. The land, the public land, is being leased for cattle grazing. It's also being used for oil and gas exploration. It seems that and for hunting licenses, it seems the horses are kind of low man on the totem pole when it comes to the use of the public land. And it really is supposed to be those lands that were designated as wild horse territories were supposed to be for the horses. They do allow multiple use, but it seems like the horses have gotten put on the bottom of that list when it comes to how the land is used.
And as one of the speakers in your film points out, that there are kind of excuses made, like the horses are overgrazing the land, and then they take them off and put on cattle.
Exactly. I mean, the excuse for pulling the horses off the land is that there's not enough forage for them to survive. There's not enough water for them to survive, and so it's quote unquote in their best interest to be pulled off the land. But immediately, cattle are being put on the same land to graze.
Well, the numbers, I mean, there's less than 30,000 wild horses left in the wild, and over 6 million cows. So for anyone to blame the wild horse for overgrazing, you just have to do the math.
Right.
The Jicarilla is a great example as far as what oil and gas does to the land. There's over 800 gas wells in the Jicarilla, and they want to bring the horses down to 100 or less. And the oil and gas wells bring in roads and traffic, and they put up fences, so the public land's no longer public, really, because it's fenced off.
And as we talked about in the show just this week, there are also potential environmental problems caused by the gas drilling.
Mm-hmm.
So horses and their relationships to people. There is in your film, Donna Wells, a woman who is some kind of animal
communicator,
therapist.
She's a. It's Shelley Gibbs that you're referring to, and she's an equine body worker,
right?
And also an animal communicator, and she's a very sensitive person. She's worked on my horse. My horse had a trauma, and we couldn't figure out what had happened to her, and so Shelley was working on some other horses in the barn, and so I asked Shelley to come and work on my horse. And it's amazing the sensitivity that she has in working with horses and their bodies, and just having the horse in a certain sense tell her what the problem is. And it could be the problem is the human that owns the horse, and perhaps they're not being treated in the way that they would like or how they can thrive. And Shelley can pick up on that, and she can really help facilitate the relationship between the human and the horse. She's really a wonderful, wonderful person.
We're talking to Jackie Fleming and Donna Wells about the film She Had Some Horses, and we're going to also get to the event that's happening tomorrow night. Now, in the film, you also have a number of horse photographers, and tomorrow night we're going to be having this whole horse photography contest, and the contest winners will be at Collected Works Bookstore. But horse photography is really an art and a craft. It's so interesting, and there are a number of people who do it and who are training students in horse photography.
Right. Lynn Pomerantz is in the film, and she takes people out actually on wild horse photography workshops. It's kind of like a safari situation where you're going out, and she leads people on the public lands and also to Jackie Fleming's sanctuary. And Sandy Claypool, who's also in the film, has a sanctuary, and she takes people there as well as the wild horses that are in Placidas and the wild horses up on the Jicarilla Wild Horse Territory. She's wonderful. She's been photographing horses and has a real sensitivity for horses and watching them and just getting the right shot. And she takes people out, and she's not a real hands-on kind of trainer, but she manipulates people so they're in the right position to get the right light. And I think everybody that goes out with her on the workshops really has a great time and comes back with wonderful photographs. Rachel Waller is also in the film, and she's one of the people who go out with Lynn to the Jicarilla to photograph the wild horses. Rachel's father wrote The Bridges of Madison County.
Oh, okay.
And she takes her daughter, her 8-year-old daughter, Cheyenne Rondeau, who is part Crow Indian, out to see the wild horses. And Cheyenne is very much a wild horse advocate. She raises money for the horses. And
yeah, this girl's amazing.
Isn't she amazing?
Yeah.
I mean, she's
this little 8-year-old horse advocate who has the voice of a child and the demeanor of a young adult, mm-hmm. who is a passionate yet calm advocate for horses and is raised thousands of dollars with like penny cans in her school and things like that.
Exactly. And she writes letters to her friends and encourages them to, you know, put money jars and collect pennies and stuff. So it just shows you what a grassroots effort can do. And that's actually how Wild Horse Annie got the first act, the 1971 act passed, was she started in the schools with the school children, and that's how the whole movement came about.
So. And so I saw something the other day about Wild Horse Annie, and she did that long before internet and all of that networking came about, all these thousands and thousands of letters from school children to the government to save wild horses. When you think about that, you think, how did you ever get the word out prior?
Yeah, organizing was not born in 1995, ladies and gentlemen.
Right, right. But Cheyenne is a great advocate, and, you know, if Wild Horse Annie could do it, Cheyenne could do it.
and no doubt will.
And no doubt will, exactly.
And at the same time, these wild horses are under tremendous threats, and it looks like mostly or primarily from the Bureau of Land Management. Is that right?
Well, that's true. It's the situation right now is pretty grave. It just seems like their rights have been eroded more and more, and you know the BLM is caught kind of in a situation where their management plans just are not working at this stage of the game. So you have advocates on one side who are demanding, you know, different management practices, and then you have Other segments of the population, the public who say, you know, wild horses are not an important issue, you know, economics or other things are an important issue. So it's really difficult. I think that the BLM right now is trying to do a study with the National Science Institute. There's a panel of people that are trying to come up with some recommendations about the best way of managing wild horses. We believe that the best way of managing wild horses would be to leave them out on the public lands and to use birth control, PZP, to help regulate their populations. We also, I think it would be nice if there were more current environmental assessments of the public lands. It's like the data that they're using to say what the maximum amount of horses should be on the public lands is outdated. And as we know, you know, if you're doing it 10 years ago and there was a drought, your numbers about the appropriate number of horses is going to be very low. And so that's what they're doing, is they're trying to bring the populations down to those numbers. But wild horse advocates are saying that's old data.
Well, their current system is to round them up and adopt them, but there's over 40,000 horses unadopted in the pens, and so it's not only not working, it's not been working for a long time.
Well, and that's it's a form of cruelty, borderline, I don't mean to put human metaphors on animals all the time, but it's like a kind of slavery.
It is. But I've been
or
to
not even slavery, prison.
I've been to BLM pens, and you know, the ones I've seen, they're not all horrible, but they're just, it's not a great life either. They're just standing in pens for the rest of their lives. And a lot of them, I mean, this year we've adopted 5 horses, and 3 of them were on the adoption circuit for over 3 years each, which means that they had been going from adoption event to adoption event to adoption event, never being adopted. So spending a lot of time in trailers on the road. And they're
wild. It's not like
they're wild. They're not domestic horses, which is different than just, you know, trailering a domestic horse that's used to getting on a trailer. These are wild horses.
So it's hard for them. I mean, so the best life, you're both saying, for wild horses is to be in the wild.
Yeah.
With their family groups.
I mean, that's the thing
that when they're rounded up, their families are torn apart. It's as you said, it's like being in prison. It's, you know, suddenly you're separated from, you know, your family and your band. The horses that you've lived with and grown up with and that have a meaning to you, you're totally separated.
Well, when you see these roundups, you know, that one day they're out there with their family on the range, and then the helicopter shows up, and they're all chased down by a helicopter. And some of the footage you see of these helicopters, they come.
It's awful.
So
I've seen that on YouTube.
Close.
Oh God.
Yes, and then as soon as they go into the chutes, they're separated, males and females and yearling babies or whatever are taken away from their mothers.
It is like prison.
And that's it. I mean, the life that they knew is completely eradicated just in one day. And they are completely dependent on the human factor. And, you know, if they're lucky, they've got some people, because not everybody in the BLM is a horrible person. They're just doing a job.
Right.
If they're lucky, they get decent treatment. But we just adopted a Mustang this year that was adopted. She was rounded up in Wyoming, spent a year and a half in a BLM pen, was adopted in North Carolina, spent about a year and a half to 2 years with a woman that had all these good intentions but never really followed through, was going to euthanize the horse because she didn't know what to do with it. She gave the horse to one of the workers at the barn, and then the next thing we know is this summer that horse showed up. She was abandoned in a one-horse trailer on the side of the road.
Good heavens.
In over 90-degree heat, just left there. And she was emaciated. She had what they call rain rot all over her body from being out in the elements. And she had wounds on her legs where somebody had either badly hobbled her or just tied her legs together. And so it isn't always a great thing that they're adopted, because it takes a special person to adopt a wild horse.
Well, when you adopt it, it's not like you're going to then ride it.
No.
You're going to basically set it free.
When I do, you mean?
Well, yeah. You or other people who adopt them.
Well, no, a lot of people will adopt them to make them into riding horses.
And does
they
that work
can.
Out?
Yes.
It does.
Yeah. Many successful riding horses.
They have a thing called Mustang Magic where the horses that have been brought in from BLN and have been adopted, they have these contests where trainers and other people who have experience with horses take the horses and work with them for 90 days, and then they have a competition.
Extreme Mustang Makeover.
Yeah, to see...
no.
Yeah. But the horses are wonderful. They're very trainable. They're very intelligent, willing horses. I mean, they're wonderful. And
some of the things... And they have a time limit on what... how long they can train these horses.
I think it's
2 months? Something like that.
Yeah, 2 months or 90 days, I think. And then they have a competition to see, you know, against each other.
And it's designed to try and encourage adoptions.
It is.
To show people that these horses...
what they're capable of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But meanwhile, it's all tied with issues of land conservation on public land, because the land that they're taking the horses off of is then being used for things... mostly extractive industries, and some people think of cattle grazing as an extractive industry in a funny way too, that often, more and more often than not, are a little or a lot harmful to the land.
Oh, very destructive. I mean, just the road systems that go in. And if you've been to, just in New Mexico alone, up to the Farmington area or the Artesia area, and you're driving along, it's one after the other after the other after the other of wells. They don't just put one or two in there. Like I said, the Jicarilla's got over 800 gas wells in there, and that all requires a road to every single one of them, and pump jacks that are run by generators. So, you know, any idea of peace and quiet out on the in the forest lands doesn't exist anymore.
Right. We're talking to Jackie Fleming and Donna Wells. Now, your film, Donna Wells, She Had Some Horses, is screening tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore. And there is a reception at 5 o'clock for the winners of the photo contest. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, every year, we've only done it for 2 years, but this is our second annual contest where we do an equine photo contest. It's designed as a fundraising event, but, you know, it's really fun to see the kind of entries we get, some fantastic guests. I'm so glad I'm not a judge. Our judge is... I can always say, I didn't judge it. But our judges are Lynn Pomerantz, who's in Donna's
film. A wonderful photographer. I mean, the thing about this horse photography that you show in the film, and Tony Stromberg, who we've talked to on the air, I mean, they're so emotional, and the sort of kinship that we have with these animals.
They're soulful pictures.
We can see ourselves in them and them in us. Mm-hmm. I mean,
and you can see that they're all individuals. I mean, that's the thing, I think, when, especially with lens photography, who I'm, you know, most familiar with, is you really do see the individual. And so when you imagine these horses being gathered up on moss, you know, and taken off the land, it's 30,000 individual horses, individual personalities, and that are being taken off. And I think because of that, you do experience the loss. It's more personal because you can see that there is an individual there.
The other judge is Greg Albrecht, and he's a fantastic photographer as well.
He is.
So there's Tony Stromberg, Greg Albrecht, and Lynn Pomerantz, all of which take beautiful pictures of horses. So, and they're going to have works up in the show as well.
The judges as well as the contest winners.
And Tony Stromberg's going to be doing a book signing for his two books, and Lynn's going to be doing a book signing for her book. So,
so many, many opportunities to see and take home horse photography.
I know, and I'm like, it's nearly Christmas, folks.
Right.
If you have anybody out there who loves horses, this is a great time, because the artwork is all for sale. So, our winners this year did some absolutely beautiful photography. I'm very proud of them all.
Now, is this a benefit for the Cimarron?
Yes.
Cimarron Sky Dog?
It's a fundraiser.
But
we're obviously tied into photography a lot. I love equine photography, and a lot of the people that help us out are photographers. Lynn's been a great friend to our sanctuary, and Tony and Greg, all three of them.
And remind us why it's called the Sky Dog Reserve.
Well, Sky Dog is sort of an It's a Native American. It's the English version. I think it's... I don't even want to say it in Native American because I'll make a fool of myself, but it's from a Native American name for a horse, which... The story goes that when the Native Americans first saw the horses when the Spanish brought them back to the country, they thought they were large dogs that were sent to them by the father in the sky. And so it was a gift from the gods. And I love that because I really do think that they are a gift from the gods. And
they refer to dogs, which are the other greatest creatures.
Right, exactly.
Well, they used to use dogs as actually like work animals. Used to put packs on their back and
right.
everything.
And
so when they saw them, they went, wow, that's a big dog.
And a very good dog.
Yeah.
Jackie Fleming is founder of the Cimarron Sky Dog Reserve Wild Horse Sanctuary. Donna Wells is producer and director of the film She Had Some Horses. We will see you tomorrow night at 5 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore here in Santa Fe. And that's at 5 o'clock for the reception and then 7 o'clock for the film screening.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you very much
Thank you for having us. Yes.
I'd like now to welcome to the program Shirley Jacobson. She is with the New Mexico chapter of the New Deal Preservation Association. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
Now, the New Deal Preservation Association, what is there to preserve? Why is it such a big deal?
Well, because New Mexico, among all the other states, had an incredible arts program, as you would imagine. And we have many, many buildings that were decorated by New Deal art, by the way this worked was. Let me tell you how it worked.
Yeah, and remind those of us who are under 25 about what the New Deal even was.
Well, it was a program from the Roosevelt administration to put people, the WPA was a program to put people to work. Just what we need today.
Right.
Okay? And the way the program worked was that the government paid for the labor. It didn't pay for the material, and if it were books, it didn't pay for the printing of the books. It paid for labor. And artists in this state were given projects. We had a portfolio that was done of silkscreen, of Spanish colonial art, and we had murals done all over the state. And we preserved these murals. These murals were done in the 30s, and a lot of deterioration occurred. And we've spent over $500,000 restoring murals. All over, from Raton to Roswell.
Now, one of the things that's so interesting about the New Deal art programs was that they weren't just in the capital cities. I mean, they were all over the state.
Yeah.
So what are some examples, and what are some of your favorite New Deal artworks?
Well, personally, it's the artists that intrigue me. There is one done in Taos at the courthouse by Bistrom. I mean, these were absolutely top-notch artists. The portfolio, you see, I'm a book dealer, so I know a great deal about the writers and the book part of it. And the portfolio was exquisite. E. Boyd, who was the head of the Spanish colonial at Folk Art, ran this program, and she went into all the sanctuarios, and she copied things. And then they took her copies and did woodcuts on Gus Bauman's press in El Rito.
Now, she was quite an artist herself.
Oh, yes, yes. And they did. They took the prints and gave them to artists in quotation marks, people all over the state, to hand color. And some of them were very, very good, and some of them were not so good. But they needed the money, and this was the way they did it. And the feds were very upset by this because they wanted everything to be uniform. So they wanted silk screens, and we did them by hand coloring. So they were woodcuts, they were originally done, and they were originally drawn, and they were originally colored. And they took back all the portfolios, or practically all of them, but there's some that escaped, and they have shown up, and they're very, very valuable.
I can imagine.
Yeah.
Why didn't they like them?
Because they not only did they want each image in the portfolio, and I can't remember whether they were 30 or 40 of them, to be of the same quality of art as the one next to it. They wanted each portfolio to be the same.
Right.
And if you silk screen, you get a uniformity.
Right. So there are some murals, and there were some murals here in Santa Fe.
Yes. I believe that... I'm not sure whether the murals at the at Fine Arts was done. They were done. I don't know if they were done on the WPA. They were
the
done
New
by Schuster.
Art Museum.
Yeah, they were done by Schuster. But the one in the Federal Building, and there's one by Cassidy, I think, in the Federal Building. That's the Santa Fe ones. But actually, you know, they were done in post offices all through the state. They were done in Roswell. They were done all over.
And there were some at the Indian School in those buildings that got knocked down.
Yes, but the one that we're doing with, you see, the Indians were brought to Washington to do the Department of Interior building. It was a new building, and Ickes, who was the head of the Department of Interior, insisted that Indians should do the murals. And famous Indians, Hauser, Naylor, Herrera, and Woody Crumbo, did a mural, did more than one, at the Department of Interior. And Gerald Naylor Jr., who is the son of Gerald Naylor, took a photo of that and painted that picture. And the picture is the four artists sitting with three secretaries in front of the one of the murals. And we're going to have that at the coming book and antique show at Garrett's Desert Inn.
Well, let's talk about that. So not this weekend, but next weekend on the 19th of November, which
right.
I think is a Saturday,
right.
There is a book and antique show. Now, it's the annual antique and rare book sale. They're not all rare books, but you're a book dealer. Tell us about what kind of
selection. Well, there's
of books.
New Mexico and WPA stuff that I'm bringing, and other people are bringing. And then there are reading copies of things. There's New Mexico material. There's Indian material. There's Indian arts and crafts. There's jewelry. There's vintage clothing from the era. And anything you could think of. And we have a lot of fun.
Now, when you look at that era, I mean, there are so many artists who participated in it from all over the country. Is there any kind of continuity of style, or is the work all over the map?
It was realist, mostly.
Yeah.
We didn't have impressionism, and we didn't have modernity. You know, we didn't have surreal. We didn't. It was all very, and it was political. A lot of it was political. You know, it was factories and schools and, you know, that kind of thing.
Right. Almost, I mean, when you describe that, it sounds almost like socialist realism.
Well, it was close. It was close. Because, of course, that was it. It was a celebration of American... that's exactly what it was. It was a celebration of American power and American ingenuity, and that's what was done. When the Indians did theirs, of course, it was their dances and ceremonies and that kind of thing. Which, of course, is also a celebration of Americanism, right? Since they're from here.
Right. Perhaps more than anybody
else. Right. Exactly.
Now, there have been a number of books done on this subject of the WPA, of the New Deal art experience in New Mexico.
Yes, Kathy Flynn did Treasures on New Mexico Trails, which she did when she was Assistant Secretary of State. And it takes you on a trip to all these places, and it shows you the murals and tells you about the artists. There's also an absolutely marvelous book done in 1940 as part of the writer's series, and that program was to have a state guide for every state in the union. And I think the New Mexico one was absolutely the best because Laura Gilpin and Ernest Nee did the photos. And it is so beautiful. And, of course, it has all the things that, not all the things, but a lot of the things that have disappeared. So it was, and it has a map. And it would, a good copy with a dust jacket and the map would cost about $75 to $100 today.
That book, okay, it's about all these different places in New Mexico. Have you ever used that, or could you use it as a guidebook?
You could, and people do. They've been reprints. There was, I think there was a paper reprint. It was done under the auspices. Remember I told you that, oh, they only could pay for the labor? It was done under the auspices of the Coronado Centennial. And it has been reprinted since, you know, in paperback. And you can get a paperback copy and use it and travel. Yeah.
It's always interesting to look at art in relation to the economic situations that it came from, because some of the most interesting and vibrant art comes from hard times.
Yeah, right, right. Well, the artists were instructed, they didn't have carte blanche, you know, and things had to pass muster, as well as the books. The books had to go to Washington, the proofs had to go to Washington for them to go over and make sure that it fell into the right category. Of course, all the state guides have the same structure, and so and there were many different aspects of this, because it went even further, went to cities. We had in New Mexico a calendar of events which was illustrated by artists. And it was for, I think, the year 1938. There were two done. And so you had, I think Chapman did one of the covers on this. And it's a gorgeous little thing.
So the event that is coming up, not this weekend, but next weekend, is a fundraiser for the New Mexico chapter of the New Deal Preservation Association. It's at Garrett's Desert Inn here in Santa Fe on Old Santa Fe Trail, just
right,
a few blocks off of the plaza.
Right.
On Saturday the 19th. And what time?
It goes from 8:30 to 3:30. There's free parking, which is...
We like free parking.
We like free parking and free admission.
And what if people have books that they want to donate? Do people do that?
Well, at this point, it's they can contact me, yes, 670-8315. That's my cell phone. We'd be glad to take anything they want to donate. Of course, we've also invited the sons of these artists. So we expect to have four sons. We expect to have Harold Herrera and Gerald Naylor, of course, who did the painting, and Philip Hauser. And we've invited Woody Crumbo Jr., but I don't know whether he's going to come. But we certainly are going to have a couple of them.
Shirley Jacobson is with the New Mexico chapter of the New Deal Preservation Association, and the website is newdeallegacy.org. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Shirley Marischala. Thank you very much.
I'd like now to introduce Raphael Wiseman. He is the president of the organization Healing the Scars, which is presenting the event Live as One, Occupy the Heart. It's a full-day festival on 11-11-11, November 11th, 2011. Welcome.
Thank you.
So what's the idea behind the event?
The event is a global celebration of oneness, and the intention of the event is to bring together the hearts of millions and millions of people around the world in that space of the heart, connect them through what we call the threads of the heart, and then bless water as we do that, and let the water carry that blessing and that the vibration of the oneness, so that water, because it has the ability to hold memory and to carry intent, can then spread that. We're all mostly water. We breathe in water vapor, we breathe it out, the atmosphere recycles that and spread it around the world. And if you put one drop of blessed water into an ocean or a body of water, the vibration and the intent and the prayer and the blessing will actually go into that water. So the purpose of the event, in a sense, is to bring together so much consciousness in a place of wholeness and oneness that it shifts the consciousness on the planet so we can move towards a more benign world, towards peace, towards recognition and dignity for everyone.
So when you say this is going on worldwide, your organization is working with lots of other organizations?
We are sending links around the world to all the other organizations that are organizing events on that day. 11-11-11 is kind of like I hate to use the word portal because it's very new age, but in a sense there's something going on the planet that's recognized by everyone as something special. And it's happened in association with the movement of democracy around the planet, the Occupy movement. So we're all interconnected, and that's the point. Because of our interconnectedness, we have that, and because people are now stepping forward and saying no more, we want to have a world that is benign, that you know is going to take care of people who are overlooked, who don't have a voice. And we want to be able to change the vibration on the planet to move towards solutions and towards equity, towards freedom, and towards a dignity for all, so everyone can have a place and our interconnectedness with the rest of life. So it's not just about humans.
Yeah.
Because we're all, you know, we go down or we rise up together.
And so it's in Santa Fe at the Farmers Market and the Rail Yard Plaza, and there is a water blessing ceremony at, ladies and gentlemen, you guessed it, 11:11 in the morning.
Right.
And then there's art, music, and dance, and all kinds of things happening all day. How did you put it together? Did you sort of put the word out and people showed up?
I've been working on the vision for this for many years, and specifically for the last year and a half or so. I had a team that all came together and we actually changed the name to Live as One from something else. And it then went dormant for a while. And it felt like nothing was going to come together until all the ingredients were there so we could bake the pie. And that just only happened when I finally got to move here around September and then started meeting and connecting. And when I made the commitment to put my own money down to rent the building at the farmer's market building was available on that day. And then, I was vacillating and going through all my doubts and things. But as soon as I decided I have to commit, and I put down the deposit on the building, and then people started to show up. And the group of people that has blended together to create this event is mind-boggling. Amazing, amazing resources.
So there's lots of activities all day. There's dance and music. There's a lot of stuff for children, which is very sweet. It goes on from 10 in the morning until probably midnight. Is that right?
That is right, yes. We're going to end with another water blessing and heart thread session, 11:11 p.m. And then we're going to dance till midnight. There'll be... The whole thing is to celebrate. The idea is to celebrate, join together people of all different varieties, just to come together and have fun. And there's a movie called Thrive, which is premiering on that day around the world.
Is that right?
Yeah, there's been a snippet on the website that you can look at. But essentially, it's a two-hour movie that is going to be quite spectacular. And we're going to see the movie. I think we'll have a full hall for that.
So all of this is Friday, 11-11-11. Rafael Wiseman is the president of Healing the Scars. Now, I have to ask you, are you going to do something on 12-12-12?
I think something's going to show up, and I have no idea. This is all like being orchestrated beyond, human endeavor in a way. There's so much angelic help. All the creatures want this to happen. So, we're bridging many worlds, and that's the idea, is to bring everything together so oneness can be experienced rather than just talked about.
How can people find out more about the event?
Okay, there's a website called www.liveasone, all one word, -11-11-11.com, and then /Santa-Fay. That will get you to that page. We're on Facebook as Live as One.
Okay.
And there's also a Facebook event.
Okay, so people can check all that out.
All of that is constantly being updated.
Excellent.
And my phone number is 505-989-3283 is a landline. And my cell is 575-770-1228.
Thank you so much, Raphael Wiseman, for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
And thank you for having me.
And I'd like now to welcome back to the show Tatsuki Ijichi. He's the president of Tide Point Pictures, and there is a world premiere of a silent Japanese vampire movie, which is opening in Albuquerque Saturday, November 12th at 8 in the evening, and then Sunday, November 13th at Warehouse 21 at 3 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hi, how are you?
Good. It's great to have you back. Now, this sounds fascinating. A Japanese silent vampire movie with live jazz accompaniment.
Yes. I think this is the first Japanese contemporary silent film about vampire.
I mean, I just saw a film called The Artist at the Santa Fe Film Festival, which was also a silent film. Is this a new trend? People are starting to make silent films again?
I am not sure, but the filmmaker, this Japanese filmmaker, tried to make something, looks like a silent film.
And so this is a film, it's called Sanguivorous, not sure exactly how you say it, but it's a film about somebody who realizes that they are descended from a long line of vampires. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. The Japanese filmmaker found some interesting true story.
A true story?
Yeah.
What do you mean a true story?
I mean a historical true story.
So about vampires?
Yes.
But there's no such thing as vampires.
Yeah. Vampire is, exist. That's what he said.
The filmmaker says vampires exist.
Yeah. So he found something. The vampire, European vampire, imported from, Europe at the time. That's 18th centuries in Japan. So he is right now developing the project, goes to more Hollywood entertainment project. It's
okay.
Like a samurai versus vampire. But this is more like a preview.
Okay.
But this is not ordinary J-horror, more like an experimental film.
So it's an experimental film about vampires. It's called Sanguivorous. Now tell us about the jazz duo that's going to be playing.
Yeah. The jazz artist, actually the Japanese percussionist.
A Japanese percussionist.
Tatsuya Nakatani, he saw this film maybe 6 months ago. And I thought also his music perfect for this new soundtrack. So I asked him, can you adapt new soundtrack for this movie? He said yes. And the project begins.
Well, it sounds like an amazing event, and once again, it's the world premiere of the Japanese silent vampire movie, Sanguivorous, and it has live jazz accompaniment Saturday, the 12th of November at 8 in the evening in Albuquerque at the Chemo Theater, and then Sunday in Santa Fe at Warehouse 21 at 3 in the afternoon. Tatsuki Ijichi is the president of Tide Point Pictures. Thanks for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you so much.